I'd like to ask Liz Scanton to speak to us. Extremely interesting. The 1855 Wairarapa earthquake, although it was given that name like the so-called Napier earthquake, it affected a much wider area. So she's also very knowledgeable about local history. So Liz, I will hand over to you.
Thank you
very much.
Well, good morning, everyone.
For our sins of offering our services, we now find we're
in much demand.
Yes. In my family, I have two published books of my family history in New Zealand, and in one of the books there is a written account by a great aunt of her early life in New Zealand. So the recent events in Christchurch made me reread the account, and it has great relevance to what has happened in Christchurch and, of course, in Hawke's Bay. That's Wellington Harbour, 1840 to 1850, and this is Wellington City here. And then here is from Tony in the Hutt River and looking back the other way, and that's 1850. Quite relevant to the time of the 1855 Wairarapa earthquake. Well, the 23rd of January 1855, it's a very important date in our New Zealand history, because on that day, Wellington was celebrating the arrival of the first Scottish and English immigrants off the early boats that had arrived in the harbour in January 1840. And it was celebrated as a regional public holiday. It was called Anniversary Day, and what do we have today? Wellington Provincial Holiday, still celebrated as a public holiday, round about the 23rd of January. So it's a very important date. It was a fine, clear day, lovely, as you well know, Wellington can be. And it was a day of picnics, festivities, fun, and on the harbour there was a regatta. And there was absolutely no indication of what was to happen later that night. According to my sources, which are reputable and reliable resources, both the New Zealand government's GeoNet website and Te Papa's official website, and a symposium that was held on this very earthquake in 2005, sponsored by Victoria University, with the most learned of people within earthquakes and effects of earthquakes. The earthquake struck about 9:32 that evening, and it is the most powerful earthquake New Zealand has had since the beginning of the records in 1840. Now, bear in mind, they did not have Richter scales, but geological investigation methods today can and have provided us with these figures. It struck at a depth of 33 kilometres, so it was quite a deep earthquake. It happened along the Wairarapa Fault. Now, we have a gentleman here who can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't want to get too much into detail. But the Wairarapa Fault runs down the eastern side of the Rumataka Ranges, coming out through Palliser Bay and right out into Cook Strait. Roughly 100 kilometres of that fault line ruptured. That's huge, absolutely huge. So with the consequence of the 8.2, this side of the Wairarapa, right down here, was thrust up. And round this part here, if you ever are fortunate enough to be able to sail around there, you can actually see the level of the coastline that was thrust up. Huge upthrust here in Cook Strait, the seabed. Well, what happens when you have upthrust under the sea and so close? Within minutes, there was a tsunami that came in through the Wellington Heads and into Wellington Harbour. The tsunami was 10 metres. Now, you're looking twice the height of this room. I would say this would be about 15 feet, you know, so you're looking at 30 feet. The tsunami flooded Lambton Quay and many other areas. The Rongotai Isthmus, where the airport is today, Miramar, were probably at least a metre underwater. upthrust was also evident in Wellington and Lower Hutt, and of course a lot here in Wairarapa, but I'm basically concentrating on this area. The Basin Reserve that sits there today that you know so well, well, that's built on land that was upthrust at that time. And then of course round the Wellington Hutt motorway, this is a huge landslip which is still visible today if you know where to look. And of course we've got the motorway and the railway built around there. There was a track, but now like it's the width. And there has been some reclamation, but however, that was it. The quake lasted 50 seconds, and there were at least 250 aftershocks in the following 12 hours. And it was experienced over most of New Zealand, certainly from Auckland to Dunedin. All this is written documentation, very easy to access. And next day, on the 24th, people in New Plymouth reported that if they were sitting down or leaning against a wall, you would feel a constant vibration, which must have been a little bit unnerving for them. Sand blows occurred in Wellington, in the Hutt, in the Wairarapa, in the Manawatū, and these are caused by groundwater erupting to the surface as a result of the enormous shaking underneath. So you've got the groundwater accompanying with sand and silt. Is that familiar to you? Yes, as we know it today, liquefaction. The aftershocks continued for several months, and many of those would have been 5 to 6.4 on the Richter scale, and hundreds and probably thousands were 4 plus. So there's no difference between the Hawke's Bay earthquake in Christchurch and Wairarapa. But amazingly, there were only approximately 6 to 9 fatalities reported and 5 people hospitalised. There must have been hundreds of minor injury. The Wellington fatality, there was only one, was a Baron von Alsdorf who ran outside and one of the brick chimneys fell down and killed him. 2 people in the Manawatū were caught in fissures in the earth opening and closing, never to be seen again. Your worst nightmare, that one, isn't it? And a Maori family, they don't know how many in the family, in the Wairarapa were killed when their forehead collapsed on them. Now, in the 1855 Blue Book, blue, because the cover is blue, and that's its official name, which is the official book of the government of the time for all government departments, and they gave an annual report on revenue expenditure statistics, you know, all those sorts of things. What was interesting there was that the number of settlers in New Zealand were 28,561 males and 23,038 females. Isn't that wonderful? Giving the grand total of 51,599 settlers. But the Maori population was purely estimated, and they thought that was about 56,000. So you probably had living in New Zealand some 107,000 to 110,000 people. But still, the number of fatalities was quite amazing, because you would have thought there could have been terrible fires, which no doubt there was. And probably you are wondering why there weren't more in Wellington. Well, in 1848, on the 16th of October, Monday, at 2 o'clock in the morning, there was a 7.8 earthquake along the Marlborough, you know, that originated in the Awatere Valley in Marlborough. And this caused huge destruction in Wellington. Most of the brick buildings were down. So the rebuilding, which had started, was basically all in wood, weatherboard. So they did learn something, didn't they? So that's the scene and a little bit about it. We now come to my great-grandparents, Thomas and Margaret McKenzie. The only other photograph I have of them, they are younger, but it's not as clear. In 1840, my great-grandparents came to New Zealand. Thomas was a young man of 20, and he came from Scotland. And Margaret was 16, and she came from Scotland with her parents. He came on the Oriental, she came on the Blenheim. And they met, he carried her ashore, actually. He waded out to the boat and carried her ashore. And they married 2 years later. However, here they were some 15 years later in 1855, about 150 kilometres north of Wellington, living between Bulls and the mouth of the Rangitiki River on their property called Poitsfield of 800 acres. Great-grandfather had bought it. You may well recognise the name Flock House. Subsequently, Flock House was sold out of family ownership in 1909, I think, and it was bought and Flock House then was built. But that is my Mackenzie family property. Their house, the original house that they built there, was a six-room house built of totara slab walls with clay and a toi toi thatch roof with an inner bark of the totara tree as a lining of the roof. That was very common of the early settlers, what they built their houses of, and they were watertight, warm. There are actually little bits of remains of totara houses around because, as you know, it is such a hard wood. So there they were with eight of their children asleep, their eldest Eliza 11 years and Daniel 6 months. That family increased to 19 in the next 6 years. And here they are with 18. Sadly by then Daniel had been killed. He was 20. They all grew to adulthood. My grandmother's the 14th. My father had 93 first cousins. I'm very proud of that. This is basically a map. Here's Bulls. This is Parawanui Road coming down to Scott's Ferry. Tangamoana on the other side, and this is the Rangitiki River. And Poitsfield is here, straddled the road, and that's their house. They built another house, and then Flock House came. And the family cemetery is there, and some Frasers lived there as well. Eliza, their eldest daughter, was an interesting lady, very interesting. She wrote a great deal, many articles for various publications, and we're very grateful that she did. And I'll just read you her account of what happened. About 10 p.m, Mother was aware of sounds of excitement and distress among the animals. The calves bleated and ran about, while theirs sedate, but anxious mothers crowded to the fence, which was near the house, wishing to comfort their young, though feeling in themselves as it seemed that something was wrong. The fowls called out, and more so the turkey sitting on the calf's fence. Then the rumble and the first jerk that seemed to lift the earth beneath her feet and throw her forward. She caught up the candle lest it might be knocked over and leave us in darkness or set fire. Mother never lost her head. Father sat up startled and at once began to call on his God, as seems to be the instinct of all people in extremities. For though they had known two heavy earthquakes, neither was nearly so severe as this. Mother waked such of the children as were asleep to be ready for anything that might happen, all but John, 9 years, who had proudly accompanied his father for part of the afternoon's boundary ride, and was so dead asleep that he could not be awakened, and wondered in the morning what had happened. My own feeling was that on the bed was a little safer than standing on the bare earth. They didn't have a boarded floor, they had a rammed earth floor, and I don't know if any of you have ever seen or had anything to do with a rammed earth floor, but you actually sweep them, you can wash them, and they're shiny, but it's earth, it's amazing. Oh dear, how good it seemed for those who had boarded floors, so I stayed strictly on the bed, and there endured all the shocks of the night. They were numerous and of varying strength. After a time, Mother gave each of us a piece. Now that means a little biscuit, a drink of milk, or something like that, and advised us to go to sleep. She did not think there would be another as bad as the first shock, nor was there, but for weeks shocks recurred, some of which would almost have been considered big at another time. As soon as it was light, our nearest neighbours, about a mile away, came to us, still shaking after their night's experiences and carrying their baby and what food was in their house ready cooked.
Our neighbour stayed with us all day, during which they got from their home some necessities, including bedding, which was spread on our floor, and where they slept regularly for a good many nights. They're going back for part of every day. It seemed easier to bear the nervous strain of the recurring shocks among one's kind. When we looked about that morning, the first thing we noticed was that the slabs of the wall seemed to stand in a ditch with sloping sides from the working backwards and forwards of the earth, and the earth at the tall centre support of the ridge pole looked to us as children as if the house had stuck a heel in the ground and twisted round on it. I think that explains it exactly. Our water supply was the clear end of the swamp that stretched along the bank, from whence we carried it in buckets, glad to have such good, clear water so near. But the first to go for water that morning found, before getting to the bottom of the bank, a step over a foot deep and a strip of mud on the side of our waterhole, which was no longer clear but yellow and horrid looking and nearly choked with raupo roots. We could never use that water again for cooking or drinking. Father took buckets and went to the river for a load. They just had to walk across the paddocks to get to the river. Of course, the bigger boys went to see what it was like and came back with round eyes to tell of all the cracks they saw while crossing the flat to the river. Large pieces of the river bank had been thrown in, and you had to walk across more beach to get to the water than the day before. Besides, in some places on the riverbed, there were what looked like the tops of tumblers, deep as a house, they thought, and it looked as if the smooth, grey, wet stuff on the ground had been ejected from those round, mysterious holes, which of course it had. After all this, the ordinary substantial breakfast helped us to feel more like ourselves. That day, the 24th of January 1855, was to us a strange, almost weird day, when the regular meals seemed the only thing not out of joint. Father not at work, and at a weekday. Of course, Mother sewed when she could. The visitors staying all day and had not really come to see us, but above all, the frequent tremors of the earth, some of them amounting to shocks and sometimes accompanied by rumbles. No one seemed to like being alone, in case of what might happen. But like all longest days, it came to an end, and I, for one, was glad to have the width of the bed between me and any possible earthquake crack in the floor, where I hoped the neighbours would be safe. So there ends Eliza's account. So, you know, I find it extremely interesting with the analogies 156 years later being virtually exactly the same. I'm very proud of my great-grandparents and their families. They were a marvellous family. They all learnt a musical instrument. They had their own orchestra. They all had the Gaelic as well as English. They're a very close-knit family. They had a family reunion every New Year's Day, and I do have photos of all these people. Pardon?
Hogmanay.
Yes, it would be Hogmanay.
And are you wearing the Mackenzie tartan?
Yes. Great-grandfather was very strict, and when he wanted to chastise the boys, as he was wont to do, and I guess when you have 10 sons and 9 daughters, I guess it's easier to do the whole lot than try to single out one. He would give them his penknife and he would tell them to go and cut a piece of superjack. So they used to have to bring the piece of superjack to their father. My father remembered his grandfather doing that to him too, giving him the penknife. Because we'd imagine the pranks they got up to. And some of them are retold in the book. So there we go. Great-grandmother, you know, having 19 children is amazing. They lived till they were, great-grandfather I think was 84, great-grandmother was 89. And I am doubly proud of great-grandmother and her mother and her mother lived till she was 90. They both signed the woman's suffrage in 1893. So that's good on Scotland, isn't it? Stamina. They are one of the first families in that area and well remembered still by many down there. So thank you, everyone.
In Wellington and Lacton Key, there's a place where you can look through the grass floor.
Yes, of course, that's where the sea wall, you know, there are photos. The sea actually came right up. I mean, it was just the width of Lacton Key, and then eventually, after 1855, well, no, they were in the process of building it in 1855 when the quake came and the water just came straight over. I do belong to Clan Mackenzie, New Zealand, of course, so although my mother was English.
Liz, I have a record of a sea captain running from Whanganui down to Wellington. I think it was the same earthquake, and they observed to the westward a sheet of flame go up into the sky, and that's always been a bit of a mystery, but to me it suggests that was the first indication of gas fields off Taranaki. And that the earthquake had caused a rent and the sheet of flame went up, and it was just fairly transient, it didn't last for very long. But it would have been weird to have seen it from a ship.
If you're interested in the symposium in 2005, it's online, but there's also book form. There's one chapter that I found particularly interesting, which was the effects of the 1855 earthquake on people. The thing which Eliza at 11 said, Father wasn't at work, and this was all strange. I mean, Mother was fine, she kept on sewing, but Father wasn't at work. In the symposium, they actually hold Napier, I mean, it should be Hawke's Bay, because it wasn't the Napier earthquake, in San Francisco, which was 1906. They actually hold both of those up as shining examples of how communities got stuck in, got back to normal ASAP. But of course, both of those quakes had fire. But they said the thing was that they involved everybody and things were demolished. It's people who count, not buildings. And I found that very interesting. This symposium was held in 2005. It also had projections for what buildings in Wellington, because that was where the next big one was expected, building codes, building practices, and not one thing from that symposium has really been adopted. It was just something that happened at Te Papa. All these learned people who knew exactly what they were talking about, and we see 6 years later, nothing.
The rent in the Wairarapa itself was 42 feet horizontally and 9 feet vertically. So you can imagine half of this room, the land went up.
Yes, that was it. The whole of the lower North Island kind of did a thing, like the Wairarapa went up and basically a little bit over to like Te Tahi Bay and over on the west coast kind of went down a bit. But we're very fortunate that we've got geologists and so forth today that can work all these figures out for us. They identified in 2005 the symposium the Wellington Hutt motorway. They've mapped out where the next landslips will be. Nothing is done. They clear the hills and they build on them. But the interesting thing is this is the biggest since 1840. 8.2, 33 kilometres deep. A rupture of 100 kilometres in length. Enormous. Enormous.
Well, thank you very much. That was a really interesting morning. Thank you, everyone.